thanks very much. I needed to be last, both for substantive and stylistic reasons, and I need to confess that I saw Phil's PowerPoint before preparing mine. I do want to begin by congratulating the organizers of the Southern Economics Association for the non-irony of holding this session in the Hoover Room. And since Jerry mentioned economists testifying before Congress, I have to tell that the last time I testified was before the Senate Committee on Finance. And Senator Corbyn of, that was a panel of four economists, and Senator Corbyn came in and came to his time. He looked at the chairman and said, "Mr. Chairman, this is a rare and historic day in the history of the Committee on Finance. It is not often that we are privileged to have before us as a witness the star of an Oscar-winning documentary, Inside Job. Welcome, Mr. Hubbard." That was great. I mean, as an old congressional staffer, I'd never seen a witness dealt with in such fashion. Anyway. I, too, was inspired a bit by the Krugman article initially, and what I have to say today, because while he did say, of course, that the economists had got it wrong, at least superficially, and that he admitted in the article that there were a few who didn't, he didn't bother to name any of them. And given the failure in general of what passes for mainstream economics to discuss financial instability and the possibility of crisis in the years before 2008, nor even to incorporate the existence of the banking sector in the model, it's useful to begin with the obvious fact that these topics do in fact have a rich history, and every major economist from the start of the 19th century until the rise of what passes for a mainstream in the 1970s, today for the mainstream in the 1970s, was concerned with them. And I then begin with my examples, and as you can see from a PowerPoint perspective, I'm stylistically different from Phil. Marx wrote, "It is enough to mention the commercial crises that by their periodic return put on its trial, each time more threateningly, the existence of the entire bourgeois society. In these crises, a great part not only of the existing products, but also of the previously created productive forces are periodically destroyed. There breaks out an epidemic that in all earlier epochs would have seemed an absurdity, the epidemic of overproduction. And how does the bourgeoisie get over these crises? On the one hand, by enforced destruction of a mass of productive forces. On the other, by the conquest of new markets and by the more thorough exploitation of the old ones. That is to say, by paving the way for more extensive and destructive crises than by diminishing the means whereby crises are prevented." I don't happen to think that Marx's theory of crisis is adequate. It is not financial in character, and modern Marxians tend to view finance as a veil overlying deeper problems, which gives their theory a certain metaphysical cast. But it is better to have a theory of crisis than not to have one at all. Also, I think we cannot pass over Marx without remarking on this other famous passage that Hegel remarks somewhere, that all facts and personages of history of great importance in world history occur, as it were, twice. He forgot to add the first time as tragedy, the second as farce. Caussidière for Danton, Louis Blanc for Robespierre, the Montaigne of 1848 to 1851 for the Montaigne of 1793 to 1795, the nephew for the uncle. Today, I'm sure he would have written the nephew for the uncle's intellectual hero, Larry Summers for John Maynard Keynes. Thus, to bring Keynes into the story directly, in my second figure, I can get him to come up in the PowerPoint, let's see, here we are. Modern Keynesian macro modelers have forgotten about banks, but Keynes did not, in fact, and he wrote that banks and bankers are by nature blind, they have not seen what was coming. He also anticipated Epstein in writing that in the United States, some of them employ so-called economists who tell us even today that our troubles are due to the fact that prices have not fallen enough. That was in 1930. A sound banker, alas, is not one who foresees danger and avoids it, but one who, when he is ruined in a conventional and orthodox way along with his fellows so that no one can really blame him. I should also mention, it's relevant today, and particularly across the ocean, that the passage from the economic consequences of the peace, if the European Civil War is to end with France and Italy abusing their momentary victorious power to destroy Germany and Austria-Hungary, now prostrate, they invite their own destruction, also being so deeply and inextricably intertwined with their victims by hidden psychic and economic bonds. Let me come to my third figure. This one will not surprise you, perhaps, this coming from me, but my father's contributions, particularly in the Great Crash of 1929, are, I think, legion and well-known, but I shall cite simply the discussion of the concept of the bezel, which he notes to an economist is especially interesting because it has a time dimension. That is to say, while embezzlement is going on, the embezzler has their gain and the victim does not know that they have experienced loss, so that total psychic welfare in the society is improved. Meanwhile, when the embezzle is discovered, of course, the reverse process occurs and people slip into depression and public morality improves. We've seen that in the present process. And he remarked also in this book about the probability that 1929 might be repeated, that at first glance, the least probable of the misadventures of the late 20s would seem to be another wild boom and its inevitable collapse. Yet in some respects, the chance for recurrence remains good. No one can doubt that the American people remain susceptible to the speculative mood, to the conviction that enterprise can be attended by unlimited rewards in which they individually were meant to share. The government preventatives and controls are ready. In the hands of a determined government, their efficacy cannot be doubted. There are, however, 100 reasons why a government will determine not to use them. That was written 30 or 40 years before Alan Greenspan. I do have to, in the spirit of disclosure, confess that I have a financial interest in that quotation since I own the rights to the Great Crash. It did sell 50,000 copies in the years after 2008, making it one of the most successful crisis books, and certainly by far the most successful to have been written 50 years before the crisis. I quote the passage not because they effectively summarize whole theories, but they don't. Still, yes, less a single unified theory, but because they in fact stem from theoretical perspectives within which crises are possible, and within which theories of crisis were actually developed, and which argue that instabilities leading to crisis are inherent, so that crises are to be expected. None of this would be exceptional if it had not been forgotten. One could enlarge the list of neglected masters, Veblen, Schumpeter, Kaletsky, Robinson, Sraffa, Jerzescu, Rogan, to name just one living figure, Luigi Pazzanetti. I mention these people because they are names associated with what are in fact living traditions. And what all work in these traditions share is that a deep defensive ditch separates them all from the mainstream, so that students and fellow scholars who devote their attention to the mainstream will not encounter the slightest reference to any of them. This is a failure of scholarship. It is what happens when a cult seizes control, builds walls, fills the moat, and pulls up the drawbridge. And one consequence is that mainstream theory has become uninteresting. You, with all due respect, Phil, you can ignore all of it without loss. And I don't propose to discuss it anymore. Another consequence is that when mainstream economists are placed in policy roles, they are crippled by their lack of range. This is very obvious in 2008, remains so to the day. At the OMB and CBO, the models, which were informed by mainstream economics, assumed a natural rate of unemployment with a pace of reversion calibrated to the previously normal post-war business cycle recovery. The assumption implied that a deeper slump would produce a faster recovery even without intervention in the form of the stimulus package. And the calibration precluded taking into account the great meltdown since there hadn't been one in the history of the post-war statistical record. So it couldn't be part of the estimation process, and that is where the notion of green shoots, the fact that the Recovery Act was too small, and the failure to foresee that unemployment would not in fact decline come from. Nor could you communicate this from the outside, even if you were aware of it, if you had a direct line to the senior insiders. They simply had the notion of a reversion to the natural rate bred in the bone. At the Federal Reserve, the theory behind the response to the crisis was dominated by the shade of Milton Friedman, who thought it sufficient that the monetary base not be allowed to collapse. And that's what gave us QE and QE2, and the recurring illusion, which now takes the form of a call for nominal GDP targeting, that the Federal Reserve has some magic channel of influence over real activity. The experiment gets tried. Each time it's a disappointment. Thanks to the theoretical pre-commitment, nobody learns. QET will follow, and the European Central Bank, under new management trained at MIT, cuts interest rates a quarter point in the apparent hope that this will accomplish something, when of course it's very obvious that it will not. Yet another debacle stems from the theory of the interest rate embodied in models of future debt deficits and crowding out, which predict that interest rates will rise over the next few years, putting the debt dynamics of the U.S. government on a sustainable path. Behind this idea lurks the loanable funds theory, another disgraceful notion. Years ago, I asked Larry Kotlikoff why, if this fear were sensible, long-term interest rates were so low. And this was long before they fell to their present levels. He replied that the markets were crazy, a response that suggests something less than a rigorously resolute devotion to the efficient markets hypothesis. Plainly, the markets have become even crazier since, but nothing changes in the models. Over at the Justice Department and the SEC, the Treasury and the Federal Reserve, economists frame the issues to preclude serious discussion of financial fraud. Their law and economics idea was that major fraud is impossible because of market discipline. There's the amazing view expressed by Rajan in Fault Lines, by Omission in Reinhardt and Rogoff, by Commission in the Republican dissents to the FCIC report, that the private sector is clean as the proverbial whistle, while all distortions can be traced back to government policy. Meanwhile, vast crimes known to all the world, thoroughly documented in official reports and accounts by reporters, law professors, and filmmakers, go uninvestigated, unprosecuted, and unpunished. Institutional economics, as forged by Commons, is developed in my father's analysis of corporations, and given recent expression by Bill Black, who I will qualify as an economist, explains how large organizations can be taken over by criminals intent on looting them with the help of accounting fraud validated by white shoe law firms and top outside auditors. Successful enforcement practices have in fact been based on this understanding, and there's at least one substantial mainstream article by Akerlof and Romer, Looting the Economic Underworld of Bankruptcy for Profit, to explain this to the reticent. But the self-described mainstream of our profession refuses to describe it. Moving on, the Anglo-Irish Cambridge Don Wynne Godley emphasized the importance of respecting national income accounting frameworks and stock flow consistency in macroeconomic modeling and forecasting, useful for two major reasons. First, because it provides a way to monitor when major departures from past patterns are underway, such as private debt leading to the public surpluses of the late 1990s, which can provide useful early warning trend of reversals, warning of trend reversals, even though it may not necessarily do so. The main purpose to which Godley and his associates put their framework at that time. Second, stock flow consistency is a barrier to nonsense about the joint virtues of budget surpluses and private domestic saving. In a closed system, it becomes obvious that you can have one or the other, but not both, and in an open system, one is dealing with a reserve or anchor currency, it is obvious that you may not have either one, since the saving, which is the counterpart of the public budget deficit, may be done outside the country. A very simple point, but not trivial in the real world, and we could be spared a great deal of hardship and bad budget policy, including the compromise that may or may not happen in the next couple of days, if mainstream economists chose to instruct political leaders in the editorial board of the Washington Post on this point. Godley's approach is closely allied with modern monetary theory, other outposts of post-Keynesian economics. And finally, there is Hyman Minsky. Minsky produced a great deal of institutional analysis, but is most remembered for two core insights: the stability produces instability through a process of reaching for yield, and confidence building, and that financial systems experience phase transitions from safe or hedge finance to speculative positions, which must be refinanced in an uncertain future, to Ponzi positions, where the interest due must be met from new borrowing. Something that can only happen so long as the fact that a position is Ponzi remains obscured. The implied mathematical structure of a Minsky model thus mimics the phase transitions one observes in nature, or gas, liquid, solid, and water, for example. And these can be generated by simple nonlinear dynamic processes. So Minsky has descendants in modern economics who are model builders and also the econophysicists. So let's add to that, and put him up here on a slide, particularly with the body of work pioneered by Georgescu Rogan, whose aim is to develop an economics that would have the remarkable property absent from our current mainstream of being consistent with the laws of physics, especially the laws of the second law of thermodynamics. And I hesitate to say even a single other word on that in the presence of Professor Murawski. What is happening out in this world of criminologists, institutionalists, accounting consistent monetary operations mavens, and nonlinear Minsky modelers? The answer is they are talking to each other. They have mostly given up on the dialogue of the deaf with the mainstream. They are not all that interested in what people at MIT or Chicago think. They're busy putting together a new narrative based on their own canon with application to the ongoing financial crises and incipient depressions in both the United States and in Europe. Who are these people? Well, there's quite a few of them. Here's another, I said five, here's another 50, just to, for starters. They are doing this on blogs, in conferences, at sessions of the Association for Evolutionary Economics, and further disclosure, I'm the incoming president of that organization, in journals that the mainstream doesn't read, including the Real World Economics Review, soon to become the World Economic Journal. I would argue that these people are not on your reading list, and many of them are living, though a few of them are not, then you're not getting out enough, but that the profession of economics is, in fact, being renewed, and it's simply too bad that the big shot departments will miss out. But really, at the end of the day, who cares? Saltwater, freshwater, as any biologist will tell you, the backwater is where evolution actually happens. On that note, I simply invite you to add your name to this list and to leave you with a photograph. I hope you recognize that particular scene. It has since been destroyed.